he confidently climbed out of the car into the driving rain and went straight into the tangle and vine with no light to guide her. As she had the night she'd snuck into the woods behind Damon Cross's dormitory at the craft school, she thought of herself as that panther tattooed on her arm, and navigated by dead reckoning and by the swollen creeks that fed the Bayou Duquesne. The panther skirted clusters of moss-covered cypress trees. She padded through overgrown tupelo groves and ancient pine plantations choked with kudzu. She fought her way through stands of reeds and knew just where to walk to stay out of the sucking mud. The rain was incessant, but it muted all sound, a good thing. As Acadia moved, her thoughts turned to Marcus Sunday. It had been nearly 30 hours since she'd run. How was he taking it? Bad, she was sure, especially if he'd figured out she'd looted a few of his accounts. If she'd been a liability and a threat before, she was an exponentially larger liability and threat now. Acadia not only understood everything about the cross-kidnapping plot and the two murders Claude Harrow had done for Sunday, but knew Sunday's entire sordid story, how he'd made the money he'd gotten from selling his father's pig farm to the coal company disappear, how he'd managed to create a new identity after faking his death, and even how he'd had academic transcripts forged so brilliantly that he had gotten into Harvard. Acadia also knew how Sunday had planned the death of his mother's family. She'd heard blow-by-blow descriptions of how he'd killed each and every one of them. She knew the same kinds of details about the Monahan slayings in Texas. In short, she simply knew too much. Marcus was the smartest, most self-actualized man she'd ever known. An outsider who'd created his own rules, the most basic of which was his personal survival. Sooner rather than later, he'd start hunting her. So Acadia had several choices. Did she keep going after tonight? Head for Mexico and the money she'd moved there? Or did she contact the police, maybe even Alex Cross, and cut herself a deal in return for immunity and witness protection? Or did she contact the police, give them enough information to nail Sunday and save the family, but then disappear into another life? Marcus had proven that it could be done, hadn't he? An hour after Acadia entered the swamp, she still had not yet decided what she was going to do. The rain slowed a bit. She caught the faint glow of lights ahead and dropped her pace to a crawl. After every step, she paused and listened to each rustle and snap in the woods around her. She sniffed the air for strange smells, but caught only the washed scent of ozone and the perfume of rain. But the closer she got to those lights, the more her breath tasted of old and bitter memories. The place where Acadia was born, raised, and forced to commit patricide appeared in bits and pieces through the leaves. Weeds surrounded the cabin, which pitched slightly off its stone foundation. The roof sagged, and the screened-in porch defied gravity. Somewhere to her left out there in the darkness, the old dock creaked and groaned. Acadia got closer still and saw lights behind the threadbare curtains. She also heard a radio in the cabin tuned to a gospel station and a television blaring the theme song to CSI, her mother's favorite show. She stood behind a tree, studying the cabin and the yard for almost 10 minutes. The old Ford pickup was parked beneath the big cypress. A few moths flitted beneath the porch eaves and around the bare light bulb by the door. The breeze shifted. Acadia wrinkled her nose at the smell of rank water and rotted meat coming from the bayou. Years had gone by, and her mother still fed the alligators that had fed on her father's corpse. "Why wouldn't I?" she'd always say. "The gators set us free, didn't they? I owe them, don't I?" For her part, however, Acadia had not gone near the backwater where her father's pets lived since the night the old bastard died. She'd go anywhere else around the 20-acre homestead, but never, ever down there. Though not a superstitious person by nature, she thought of that sliver of wetland as cursed. Above the noise of a preacher delivering a sermon of salvation on the radio, and Gil Grissom shooting his mouth off about X-ray analysis on the television, Acadia heard the rattle of pots and pans. Her mom was probably cleaning up after a late supper in front of the tube. For several moments longer, Acadia stood there, just inside the shadows, racking her brain, trying to remember if she'd ever mentioned this place to Sunday. Maybe once. Maybe that very first drunken night when they'd met in a bar in the French Quarter. But never again. She'd made sure of that, telling Sunday that she'd been raised over on the Mississippi border northwest of Slidell. Something intense must have been happening on CSI because the music coming from the TV got all creepy. Then she heard her mother start coughing and hacking. It was enough to embolden Acadia, and she finally stepped from the trees and cut across the yard toward the cabin. Acadia thumbed the latch and opened the screened-in porch's door, expecting Mercury, her mother's beloved pit bull, to come charging out to meet her. Instead, she heard snores and spotted the old dog on his straw bed in the corner. "Some protection you are," she said. Mercury grumbled, sighed, and farted. The door to the cabin was ajar. "Ma?" Acadia called as she gently pushed it open, seeing dishes drying in a rack by the sink. She stepped inside onto the rough-hewn floor and saw her mother's overstuffed chair, empty except for the latest copy of People magazine open to the celebrity crossword. Several cans of Diet Coke sat on the TV dinner table next to her ashtray and an open pack of Pall Malls. CSI had given way to a commercial that touted a breakthrough in fabric softeners. The preacher on the radio had shifted from salvation to a theme of damnation and hellfire for all sinners before God. "Mama, where are you?" Acadia called louder. "It's me." Her mother's frail voice answered from her bedroom. "I'm back here, baby doll. Can you come give me a hand? With the rain, my arthritis is acting up." "Be right there," Acadia said, and she walked past piles of newspapers and older editions of People magazine and a plastic bag full of empty Diet Coke cans. In a short hallway that smelled of old age, she maneuvered through stacks of old magazines and boxes of moldy treasures her hoarder mother flatly refused to get rid of. Acadia pushed open the bedroom door, stepped in, and turned left, expecting to see her mother trying to button up her nightdress or tie her robe. Instead, her terrorized mother lay on the bed with her arms, chest, and ankles wrapped in duct tape. The old woman whimpered, "I'm sorry, baby doll. He said he'd shoot me if I didn't." Before Acadia could run, the cold muzzle of the pistol bumped the back of her head. "Don't you move now, lover," Sunday whispered behind her. "I found this in the closet, and I think the safety's kinda loose on a hair trigger." He pushed her toward an overstuffed chair, saying, "Admit it. You're shocked. But you've got to remember I've got the superior mind, Acadia. Total recall. You said that first night that you grew up in the seat of Jefferson Davis Parish, and after that you always said it was Slidell. Ha! How's that for a memory?" "Marcus," she said, "you left me no—" The butt of the gun clipped Acadia hard behind the ear, and stars exploded and blew her straight into darkness.
Chapter 73. Though the storms had slackened and Tess Aaliyah was able to drive 70 miles per hour, we were still a solid 50 minutes west of Jennings, Louisiana, when I said into her phone, Are we ready? We are, Mahoney said. Just do the smart shrink thing and keep him talking long enough for my men to triangulate. I'll do my best, I said, and handed Aaliyah's phone back to her. Picking up the burner cell I'd bought with Ava back in West Virginia, I prayed that FBI techs using software I couldn't begin to comprehend would be able to quickly home in on the three cell towers closest to Sunday's position. For the past 15 minutes, I'd been wrestling over what I should say to the man who had my family. By whatever name, Mulch or Sunday, he was a diabolical son of a bitch who would not hesitate to kill. And I was as nervous as I'd ever been punching in his phone number. Sunday answered on the third ring and yawned before saying,
Dr. Cross, is that you?
I'm sorry, Dr. Sunday, I said. Did I wake you?
I was just about to turn off the hotel room lights. I've got a big day planned for tomorrow.
In Austin?
That's right. You still in Omaha?
Back in D.C. And again, sorry to call, but I could use your help.
Well, of course,
Sunday said, and he yawned again.
How can I be of service?
You know, I jumped to conclusions about your book, I said, and I wanted to apologize again about that. I know we differ about the quotes you attributed to me, but I went back through the book earlier this evening and was really impressed how you got inside the perfect criminal's, or now, Thierry Mulch's, mind. There was a pause, and I heard what sounded like gospel music playing in the background before he said,
That's high praise coming from you, Dr. Cross. I truly appreciate that.
You're welcome. So, anyway, I was wondering, now that you've had the chance to consider Mulch's background, if you had come to any kind of deeper insight into his character and what he might have done with my family. There was another pause, this one longer, before Sunday said,
As a matter of fact, Dr. Cross, Thierry Mulch is all I've thought about since you told me he was my perfect criminal.
And?
Well, I don't mean to sound narcissistic, but I think I sketched him with remarkable accuracy.
How so?
I stated quite forcefully in the book that the perfect criminal would have to be, in effect, an existentialist, someone who believed there was no inherent right or wrong, no ultimate moral code in the universe.
I saw that, I said, glancing at Aaliyah, who took her cell away from her ear to make a keep-going motion with it. You think Mulch is an existentialist?
I most certainly do. Think of the drastic actions he's taken over the years. Killing his father to free and enrich himself before faking his own death. And then slaughtering his mother's family and the family of this woman you say Mulch knew when he was in high school.
Alice Littlefield, I said.
Yes. So it would be much too easy to dismiss this man as insane,
Sunday said, sounding as if he were spouting off at some academic symposium.
Quite the contrary. I think those drastic actions show that he is thoughtful and careful in the extreme, but bold in his execution, which means that he knows that he functions outside the norm, that he thinks a moral universe is folly, and that his acts are simply a means to an end. No right, no wrong. Simply tools for his purposes.
I paused, glanced at Aaliyah, who shook her head. Interesting, I said. And what end or purpose might that be? After a moment of silence, Sunday said,
I don't know. Perhaps we'll get to ask him that someday when you catch him.
I look forward to it.
As do I. Now really, Dr. Cross, I have a long day tomorrow and need my sleep.
Just one more question? He sighed and said,
One more.
In your research, did you ever come across a woman named Acadia LaDuke?
Chapter 74. Marcus Sunday closed his eyes to the sight of Acadie Leduc sprawled unconscious at his feet, took a long, slow breath, and then said, "You couldn't forget a name like that if you tried. I can honestly say Acadie Leduc's never crossed my path."
"Huh,"
Cross said.
"That's funny."
"What's funny?" Sunday said, opening his eyes.
"Well, you said you had a book signing at Whodunit Books in Philadelphia last week, and according to her credit card records, Ms. Leduc was there. She even bought one of your books."
Fighting the urge to kick Acadia in the head, Sunday said, "There were at least 25 people in attendance that night. Who is she?"
"Mulch's accomplice. We have strong evidence to link her to my son Damon's kidnapping, and we have several clear pictures of her. They'll be all over the news in the morning."
Sunday refused to give in to the sharp pain suddenly knifing through his skull, forced himself to sound shocked. "So, what, you think this Leduc woman might have come to my reading in Philadelphia on Mulch's behalf?" Sunday asked. There was a pause on the line before Cross said,
"That would make sense, wouldn't it? You write about Mulch, he's going to want to find out about you, maybe even target you. So he sends in Acadia, or maybe he was even there with her."
Sunday almost smiled. He liked where this was going now. "You think Mulch could have been in the audience that night, right there in front of me?"
"Why not? You were talking about him, weren't you? And you know how delusional criminals of this nature can be, always believing they're too smart to get caught."
"I am too smart to get caught, asshole," Sunday thought. Then he said, "So, am I in any danger?"
"We suspect he and Leduc might be stalking you, perhaps getting ready to kidnap or kill you."
Sunday laughed nervously. "Seriously?"
"Seriously. Where was your reading in Memphis?"
For a moment, Sunday floundered, but then he snagged something from his memory of the prior day. "Booksellers at Laurelwood. God, I do so many of these things. I lose track sometimes. You think one of them was there last night?"
"We can put Acadia Leduc in Memphis. She flew in from D.C. yesterday morning and rented a car at the Memphis airport."
"My God," Sunday said, feeling as if there were dogs close at his heels for the first time since Mulch had faked his death to get away from Atticus Jones. "Should I suspend the book tour?"
"No. Keep going. The FBI people will have agents at your event. Where is it in Austin and when?"
Acadia moaned on the floor, and Sunday's head began to saw with pain. He'd believed that he'd covered every base, but Cross's questions were upsetting him, forcing him to ad lib at every turn. He had not had a reading the night before, and he didn't have one coming up. Then he saw a plausible explanation. "The reading was tonight," Sunday said. "I don't actually have another event scheduled until Friday night in L.A., and that's at Diesel in Brentwood." Acadia moaned again, and Sunday felt as if he were late for something.
"Diesel in Brentwood,"
Cross said, as if writing it down. It dawned on Sunday that he'd been on the phone for almost 10 minutes, and a nub of suspicion grew into a conviction that they were tracking him. He started making noises like static and said, "Dr. Cross?" Then he made more static noises before thumbing his cell off, prying it open, and ripping out the battery. Despite the odd twist Cross had put on the facts, he thought there was an excellent chance that the detective had him pegged as Thierry Mulch, which meant that once again, he had to speed things up. It was time to cut his losses. Time to move on, he decided, squatting down to grab Acadia beneath the armpits. It was time to put an end to Marcus Sunday and all of his terrible obsessions. Chapter 75. Acadia stirred at flashes of light, water spitting in her face, and wind howling about her. She had a splitting headache and vaguely understood she was lying on her back in something chill and slimy. When she forced open her eyes, she saw only shades of darkness. Then she tried to move, and panic flared in her gut. Her wrists were bound and pinned above her head somehow. Her ankles were tied down as well. She tried to yell, but cloth had been stuffed in her mouth.
"Where am I? How did I get here?"
Then, despite the pounding in her skull, Acadia remembered her mother's terror and Sunday telling her about the gun with the hair trigger.
"Where is he? Where am I?"
Thunder cracked. Lightning scarred the sky. The wind reversed direction and gusted up a sickening stench. And Acadia knew exactly where she was. Closing her eyes, she screamed, and screamed again. But the sounds that made it through the gag, though tortured and shrill, were muffled by the wind, no more than the noise of a teapot boiling in another part of the house, or a train horn blowing in the distance, something easily dismissed on a dark and stormy night. Acadia didn't care that no one could hear her. She screamed and yanked at her restraints until the skin at her wrist and ankles was raw and her stomach seized up in knots. Flopping back in the mud on the bank above the backwater slough where her father's alligators fed, she started to sob. There was a snapping noise, and a soft glowing light came over her from above and behind her head. It came closer, grew stronger. Acadia strained against her bindings, arched her head to look backward, and saw Marcus Sunday holding two of the Coleman lanterns her mother kept around for hurricanes. Sunday hung them on barbed wire strung between fence posts driven into the ground. Her wrists were bound to the bottom of those same posts. She looked down at her feet, saw her ankles tied to two other posts closer to the water. "Your mother told me the light brings them," Sunday said, appearing at Acadia's right side. "Light and blood." He got out a pocket knife, locked the blade open, and crouched beside her. As he ran the dull blade up one side of her rib cage and across her breast, Acadia shook like someone lost in a snowstorm. "Your mother likes to talk," Sunday went on. "Funny how some people are like that when they meet a published writer, just willing to open up and tell you all sorts of crazy things about themselves."
"Please don't hurt her," Acadia tried to say through the gag.
"What's that?" Sunday said. "I can't get what you're trying to say there." She screamed at him so hard her face flamed red and veins bulged at her pounding temples. "I didn't understand that one either," Sunday said, amused. "But I got the subtext, and honestly, lover, I don't give a shit about you begging for yourself or your mother. I don't even care to hear your flimsy excuses or pleas for mercy. I just need you both out of the way so I can move on." He gestured at the slough and then up the bank to her. "And this little tableau? A gift of serendipity. An irony for me to treasure to the end of my days." Acadia panted in the mud and then screamed and writhed in agony when Sunday pressed the blade to her navel and sliced shallowly, down a good 6 inches. Blood poured from the wound. "You can imagine now, can't you?" Sunday asked. "How they'll come for the place that's bleeding first." Acadia lost all control then, screaming and weeping in convulsions of fear that went on for a full minute and left her spent and almost catatonic. "We could have gone farther, you and I," Sunday said, pocketing the knife. "A lot farther. But you pressed the issue, lover. So here you are, and here come your dead daddy's pets. I'm betting they'll make you sing before they're done."
"No, Marcus," Acadia tried to say through the gag. Please? But Sunday snorted, walked away, and didn't look back. For several long minutes, there was only the howling of the wind and the rain. Then, as if the eye of the storm was passing overhead, the rain slowed to a drizzle, the wind died, and the moon peeked out through a vent in the clouds. Help! Acadia screamed through her gag, managing to make a long, insistent whine of it. Mom! She stopped, breathed in through her nose in short bursts, trying to listen. Swish, plop, blip, swish. Acadia had known those sounds her whole life. The swish of an armored tail against cattails. The plop of a 10-foot body submerging. And the blip of a creature coming to the surface. Each noise cut deeper than Sunday's blade. Swish, swish. Swish, plop. That last noise felt like a hot sword jabbed in her back. Acadia strained against her lashings, looking down at the bank and the clouded water of the back channel, seeing it swirl like cream in coffee. Blip. The prehistoric head breached first.
Chapter 76. Shortly after 11, Tess, Aaliyah, and I raced out of Jennings on the Evangeline Highway, heading north behind the flashing lights of the cruiser Sheriff Paul Govan was driving. Behind us roared three more cruisers, each with two deputies and one with a police dog, too. None of the cars had sirens on. We had ample reason for our urgency and our stealth. I had kept Sunday on the phone long enough for the triangulation to work, and it put the man within a 5-mile radius of the cabin where Acadia LeDuc's mother lived. Not a hint of doubt now. Sunday was Mulch, and was the man responsible for multiple murders, not to mention my torture and my family's peril. And Acadia LeDuc was definitely in the area as well. Hertz had run the GPS locator and put her rental car within 3 miles of the cabin. It seemed logical to us that if Sunday and LeDuc were coming together at a remote cabin out on the Bayou de Cannes, there was a good chance that was where Bree, Damon, Janny, Ali, and Nana Mama were being held. "You okay, Alex?" Aaliyah asked. I shook my head, said, "If I'd known he was here before I called, I never would have mentioned Acadia. I may have played my hand too hard." "You needed to keep him on as long as possible," she said. "It was the right thing to do. We know he's there." "But what's he doing?" I asked. "What are he and Acadia doing?" Before Aaliyah could answer, Sheriff Govan shut down his lights and tapped his brakes, and then turned onto a slick clay road that led off into forest. 2 miles on, he pulled in behind a late-model Ford pickup and unfolded himself from the driver's seat. A long, ropey man in his mid-50s with jug ears and a straw cowboy hat, the sheriff looked like a Hollywood version of a cracker cop. But Govan had exhibited no prejudice toward me, and from our short, succinct conversations, I could tell he was certainly nobody's fool. He was smart, well-trained, and uninterested in turf wars. If he could help save my family and take down Acadia LeDuc in the process, he and his department were more than happy to oblige. Aaliyah and I climbed out and went to the sheriff, who was talking with the undercover deputy in the pickup.
"Tony says no one's been in or out since he got here,"
Govan said.
"Real quiet," the deputy agreed, "except for the wind and all."
"So they came in expecting that the road might be watched," Aaliyah said.
"Looks that way," the sheriff said. "From where Acadia left her rental to here is all wild swamp. No easy thing to get in that way."
"But we have no idea how Sunday got in here,"
I said. Could have done it by shallow draft boat, Govan said. There's an arm of the bayou comes right past the cabin. But you'd have to know what you were doing to get there in the dark on a night like this. 5 other deputies, all young, fresh-faced kids, came up wearing body armor and carrying shotguns. I wondered how much training they'd had and said, No one gets trigger happy unless it's warranted. My family could be in there, and I don't want any of them shot by accident. Several of the deputies looked insulted, but I didn't care. I needed to make the point, in spite of bruising their egos. The 6th deputy walked up, a woman named Shields, and she had a muscular German shepherd named Maxwell on a tight leash. I liked police dogs. They'd saved me on more than one occasion. The 2 track that leads into Leduc's is about 100 yards up the road, Govan said. I figure it's better we walk in a piece, spread out, and surround the place. It seemed smart, so I nodded and accepted a radio from the sheriff. We moved silently up the road, Deputy Shields and Maxwell leading the way to a narrow, muddy 2-track. The trees and vines rustled in the stiff breeze and spit rainwater at us as we trudged single file and without lights toward Leduc's cabin. At the first sight of lights ahead through the forest, we stopped, and Govan instructed 4 of his men to stay at this distance from the house and loop around it to the north. Then one pair would peel off and approach from directly behind the cabin, and the other would go to the opposite side of the yard. You just looking for now, the sheriff said quietly. That's it, looking, and then calling in what you see to me. We clear? The 4 deputies nodded as if this were the most exciting thing they'd ever done on their job. As they set off, Maxwell perked up and whined softly. What is it, boy? Deputy Shields said. Maxwell panted and then whined again. He doesn't like something, the handler said. Then I don't like it either, Govan said, and he turned and headed straight for the lights with Maxwell and Shields right on his heels. He slowed to a stop when the cabin and the yard were visible. Nothing moved in the soaked yard, which smelled of mud and decay. From inside the cabin, maybe on the radio, came the voice of a preacher of some sort ranting about salvation and damnation. The door to the house was ajar. There were several outbuildings, sheds mostly, that looked about as sturdy as toddlers. But they could hold kidnap victims, couldn't they? I supposed, but I figured the cabin to be the most likely place. Guns drawn, the sheriff and I stood just outside the screened-in porch. Several reports came in over his radio. From what the deputies could see through the windows that weren't curtained, there was no movement inside. Marcus Sunday and Acadia Leduc, I roared. You are surrounded. Lay down whatever weapon you have and surrender. We heard nothing but the radio. Govan and I watched Deputy Shields open the porch's screen door and send Maxwell inside. He hesitated on the porch and then bounded into the house. 10 seconds later, he barked furiously. He's got someone at bay in there, Shields said. Govan, Aaliyah, and I went in first, the deputy trailing. There was a comatose pit bull in the corner of the porch. We walked through the cabin's open door and entered a pack rat's den where the halls were built of stacks of People magazines and piles of Diet Coke cans. We followed the sounds of barking to a lit doorway and found Maxwell sitting at the foot of a blood-soaked bed. Acadia Leduc's mother's throat had been slashed ear to ear, the same way Mulch had killed his own mother. Shields quieted the dog with a sharp command. Then, over the radio's din, came a woman's ungodly screaming. Chapter 77.
In situations where the sane flee from danger, law enforcement officers sprint to engage it. That night was no different. But I had more skin in the game than anyone else there, and I almost ran over Aaliyah and Shields trying to get outside, every cell in my body bellowing, Bree, Janny, Nana, Damon, Ali. I rocketed off the porch and into the clearing and sprinted toward the bayou. The screams stopped sharply and then rose again in a wail of agony. Pounding past the deputies who were advancing more cautiously, I rounded a clump of trees and found a hidden part of the yard that slanted to an old wooden dock. Two cones of light came into view off to my right toward a backwater slough. As if running into an invisible brick wall, I slammed to a staggering halt when I saw unfolding in those cones of light the most disturbing scene I'd ever witnessed. So shocking that for a beat, I was frozen in place, slack-jawed, unable to process or act. In the soft light thrown by gas lanterns, an alligator crouched over Acadia Leduc, who writhed, screamed, and shuddered as if she'd been plugged into something electric. The beast had bitten out a significant chunk of her right thigh. A second creature circled the one feeding, looking for its own angle of attack. A third was scrambling up the bank toward her feet. Maxwell came flying down the hill, barking, and went straight at the alligator closest to Leduc. The reptile had been about to take another bite, but instead it turned its head to the dog, opened its bloody mouth, and let go with a hiss that sounded like a dozen alarmed snakes. Maxwell did not hesitate, but continued his charge, snapping his teeth and letting loose with savage growls and barking. For a second there, I thought the alligator would abandon its position. Instead, when the police dog got within range and darted in from the flank, the alligator snapped its long armored tail like a 200-pound whip and lashed Maxwell across his right shoulder and the side of his head. It was like seeing a boxer knocked out. One second the dog was distracting the alligator, looking sure to drive it off, and the next he had been pummeled into the mud, where he lay, twitching and senseless. What happened next will forever be burned in my mind. Sheriff Govan, his deputies, Shields, and Aaliyah all showed up at the same time. There were gasps and frozen expressions of horror on everyone. "Max!" Shields said, and she made to go forward. But Sheriff Govan was quicker. He ripped a pump-action shotgun from one of his deputies' hands and charged the alligators, shouting, "Stay back, and no one shoots unless I say so!" The sheriff of Jefferson Davis Parish slowed to a march, shotgun up, its butt welded to his cheek. Without pause, he advanced on the second alligator. It had been scuttling around Acadia, but now it was bearing down on Maxwell. Angling, cutting the beast off, Govan let go of the 12-gauge with his left hand. With his right, he reached out and stuck the barrel in the gator's eye before pulling the trigger and blowing a fist-size hole in its head with double-aught buckshot. Driven by some primitive nervous system, the creature's entire body whipped side to side, and I thought for certain the sheriff was going to get his legs broken or worse. But for a man in his mid-50s, Govan moved with quickness and agility, leaping high over the dead gator, pumping a new shell into the chamber, and landing in a crouch 2 feet from the first one, now straddling Acadia Leduc. As it had with the police dog, the bigger, feeding alligator reacted with blinding speed, twisting its head toward the threat to its meal and making a loud, serpentine cough and hiss before lashing back at Govan with its tail. The sheriff jumped again and landed right next to the 600-pound reptile, which threw open its mouth and struck sideways with his upper body and head. The violent move knocked Govan over on his back, but not before he shoved the shotgun barrel deep into the creature's throat. The alligator's jaws clamped down on the gun's steel receiver, leaving the trigger guard right up against its bloody teeth. The beast shook its head, yanking the pistol grip out of the sheriff's hand. The butt of the shotgun waved in the air as the alligator scrambled forward, front claws tearing at Govan's legs once and then twice, leaving deep gashes before both of the sheriff's hands shot up and grabbed the exposed part of the gun. He got his thumb on the trigger and slammed it backward. The buckshot blew out the reptile's spine. It collapsed on top of Govan and made a sound like a tire losing air. Chapter 78. In all my years of policing, I have seen few wounds as gruesome as that one. The alligator's serrated teeth had torn into Acadia Leduc's thigh, ripped out several chunks, and snapped her femur. The splintered bone was visible, and blood fountained with every heartbeat. "That's arterial blood," I shouted, going to Sunday's woman. I grabbed a piece of rag lying near her and pressed it hard against the wound as she wailed, shook, and shivered, and her eyes bugged out from her head. "An ambulance is on its way, Acadia," I said. "You'll live." Out of the corner of my eye, I saw the third gator slip back into the water and disappear. Acadia looked at me like I was the man on the moon, choked out, "After everything, you're trying to save me?" "Where's Sunday?" I asked. "Where's my family?" Her eyes started to glaze over, and I shook her. "Stay with me, Acadia. Where's my family?" She had managed to free one of her wrists, and she must have been racked with unspeakable pain, because she grabbed my forearm with surprising strength, which made the panther tattoo on her arm coil up. I looked at her and said gently, "Tell me where Sunday has my family. Are they here?" She said nothing. "Tell me where they are," I insisted. She remained mute, but now locked on my gaze. "Acadia," I said, unable to control the tremor in my voice, "you can redeem yourself here. You can show some goodness." Acadia blinked slowly, and then her eyes softened, and for a moment, I thought she was going to tell me. Then she whispered, "Marcus says there is no redemption cross, no God, no absolute morality. Marcus is a universe unto himself. Am I a universe unto my..." She tried to stay focused on me. Her chin moved in small, ragged circles. "Kill me," she whispered. "I can't live in a prison, Cross. Kill me. Get your revenge. Be a universe unto yourself." I stared in disbelief and horror at what Sunday had done to his accomplice in this whole mad scheme. He'd fed her to the alligators, and yet she defended his philosophy. And now she was asking me to end her life. "Not a chance," I said. "You're paying for your crimes. But if you tell me where my..." She gritted her teeth, closed her eyes, and the wounded leg began to spasm electrically. She screamed and screamed until the pain knocked her into unconsciousness. Her head lolled to the side. I shook her again. "Where's my family?" I yelled. "Tell me where he's got my family!" I wanted to release the pressure on her wound and let her bleed out, make the world a better place by her absence. Instead, I slapped her and slapped her again, trying to get her to wake up. I felt a hand on my shoulder and looked up in confusion to find Aaliyah standing there. "That won't help us when she gets to court," she said. A minute or so later, from the direction of the cabin, Firemen and paramedics rushed onto the scene and started working on Acadia and Sheriff Govan. The second I saw the needle and the morphine go into her arm, I knew it would be hours, if not days, before we could question Sunday's woman. I felt dazed and looked around as if none of it were real. Deputy Shields knelt by Maxwell, stroking the dog's head. He had regained consciousness, but looked incapable of getting to his feet.
"You're such a brave boy,"
Shields said in a baby-talk voice.
"Such a brave, brave boy."
The dog slapped its tail as EMTs rolled the alligator off Sheriff Govan, who was conscious but in considerable pain. I wanted to go to him, lend him my support, but I simply couldn't, because a thought had penetrated my brain and paralyzed me. "Sunday was here to tie up loose ends," I said. "He may have already done the same to my family. He may have already fed them to alligators or pigs somewhere else." I saw my despair mirrored in Aaliyah's face when she said, "We don't know that, Alex. We don't even know if they're here or not." We checked all the outbuildings then and found a lifetime of hoarded, worthless junk, but no evidence my family had ever been there. The EMTs rushed a gurney bearing Acadia LeDuc up the hill, and I did hate her purely then, wished nothing but ill on her soul. I went to the second stretcher, to Sheriff Govan.
"Bunch of ribs broken," he said to me hoarsely. "I felt them go when he came down on me."
"That may have been the bravest thing I've ever seen," I said. And everyone else there, Aaliyah included, muttered or nodded agreement.
"I'm just a stupid old boy got lucky," Govan said. "Plus, we used to hunt gators when I was a kid. You get to know their weak spots."
I checked my watch as they hurried him toward an ambulance. It was past midnight, and I'd been up since Aaliyah woke me too early the previous morning. I wanted to be angry and use that anger to push on, but I couldn't. Emotional and physical exhaustion crept up and strangled me. "I'm no good right now," I told Aaliyah. "I need to sleep." "I'm sure we can get a deputy to take you to a motel," she said, looking concerned. "But someone should stay to make sure the crime scene work will be admissible in D.C.
"You're up," I said.
"Dr. Cross, we're not done with this case," the detective said, trying to sound encouraging. "Not by a long shot. One call, and the FBI puts out all points bulletins on Sunday. He'll be seen eventually."
"Eventually might not be soon enough," I said, feeling leaden. "Like I said, Mulch is cleaning up. If he hasn't already killed them, he's probably on his way to do it."
"Don't give up hope," Aaliyah said, "and text me where we're staying." I promised to get her a room and then trudged back toward the rental car, not caring that it was raining again. Mulch had been here, done his dirty business, and fled, probably by skiff, and probably heading to wherever he was keeping Bree, Damon, Janny, Ali, and Nana Mama. For the first time since I'd left Damon's room at Kraft, fear got hold of me, captured me, entombed me, and I felt like dying would be better than once again facing the dark depths of Sunday's imagination.
Chapter 79. Marcus Sunday watched much of it through high-power binoculars from across the bayou. He'd relished that swirl in the chocolate water, and he'd held his breath when the first alligator prowled up the bank toward Acadia. The expression on Acadia's face before the attack was worth the price of admission. He didn't think it could ever get better than that. But then she'd gotten her gag spit out a few seconds before the alligator tore into her thigh. As Sunday heard her shrieks, saw her writhe, his fascination had soared exponentially,
In an instant, he understood why ancient Romans had flocked to the Circus Maximus when the gladiators were fighting animals. Keeping the binoculars glued to the bloody drama, Sunday thought he'd been born in the wrong time. That being here watching this was, well, exceptional. A peak experience, if there ever was one. Then Cross, the police dog, and a small army of cops had appeared out of nowhere, which shocked Sunday, made him realize just how close he'd come to being surrounded and caught before he could bring his entertaining little experiment to an end. Then the dog attacked the alligator, got hit by the tail, and was thrown to the ground. And the older cop had acted like a ninja or something, going in to save the dog and Acadia. Sunday had admired his bold moves, his elan, and his resolve, but he believed that it was too late. Bitten through the thigh like that, his lover almost certainly wouldn't survive. Right? Sunday's confidence eroded, however, when Cross pressed a rag against the wound and appeared to be talking to her. The longer Dr. Alex stayed by her side, the more paranoia tried to worm its way into Sunday's brain. What was Acadia saying to him? Could she say anything? Sunday watched Acadia's head loll to one side. Was she dead? He couldn't tell. He lowered the binoculars. Cross had been with her 30, maybe 40 seconds. Was it enough time for her to spill her guts and reveal where Cross's family was being held? It was enough time, he decided. But had she? Could she even talk? Sunday raised the binoculars again and kept them trained on Cross, anticipating some kind of hurry-up reaction, a sign that he had more desperate places to be. Instead, a woman came up behind Dr. Alex, and he just stayed there, looking at Acadia, hunched over in defeat. Sunday allowed himself a thin smile. Okay, then, he doesn't know. We move to the endgame. But how best to do it? A cautionary voice in his head told him that, Cross's defeated posture or not, he should assume that Acadia had confirmed that Marcus Sunday was Thierry Mulch. But honestly, that didn't really bother Sunday much. As a writer, he knew that names were just names. You could change them anytime you wanted because it's the actions that really define characters, not what you call them. His dear departed mother had demonstrated that. That same cautionary voice then told Sunday to cut his losses and slip away into a new identity. Forget the grand end game. Let the Cross family be found or die. It really didn't matter in the greater scheme of things. But it did matter in Sunday's scheme of things. It mattered very much. He'd thought up the premise of the game. He'd looked at it from every angle. Well, almost. Sure, there had been a few bumps in the road, but otherwise, he was roughly where he'd hoped he'd be at this point, give or take a few days. But how do I bring it to a satisfying end? Flashing on the image of the container barge rolling on the high water coming fast toward New Orleans, Sunday played with the idea of meeting the barge, getting inside the container, and shooting air bubbles into the IV lines. Kill them all and let them rot. Let Dr. Alex suffer the loss completely and permanently. And then slip away into a new identity. He had the money and the necessary documents already. Why take a bigger risk? He'd had his fun, and now it was time to move on. Sunday had just about decided to let it end like that. He would get out his phone and punch in the GPS coordinates he'd taken on the way in, get to the skiff he'd stolen, take that to his rental truck, and then drive to New Orleans. But then flashing lights across the bayou stopped him from leaving. An ambulance pulled into the yard, and it rapidly became a chaotic scene with more and more people. EMTs went quickly to Acadia's side and began working on her. So, she was alive. And now Cross and Aaliyah were searching the outbuildings. Sunday's grin returned. That confirmed it. Dr. Cross doesn't know where his wife, kids, and granny are because Acadia did not tell him. You watch. He's going to get chewed up now investigating the crime scene. He's going to be neutered, a cog disjointed and spinning with nowhere to go. Another sheriff's cruiser came into the yard, followed by a Louisiana State Trooper's car, and then another. In minutes, it would be a carnival. The investigation was moving out of Cross's control. Mentally, spiritually, and emotionally, the detective would be wandering now, isolated, lost, just as he had been the night before Easter. A zombie. Sunday checked his watch. It was past midnight. He thought again of that barge swinging south on swollen spring currents. He put the binoculars back on Cross, watched him talking to Aaliyah and looking like a man at the end of a long, weak rope, already fearing his loss, already willing to grasp at the last strand. Strand of what? Hope? The last strand of hope? Like a pile driver, it hit Sunday then. In a single blinding instant of insight, he finally understood how he would end the game and the story of Dr. Alex Cross.
Chapter 80. As I walked back along the two-track toward the dirt road that accessed the Bayou de Canes, the breeze was stiffening again, and with it the rain, and there were rumblings of new storms to the west. By the time I got to the Jeep and started driving toward Jennings, jagged lightning tormented the night sky. Each crack of thunder made my head feel as if it were coming apart. I needed water. I needed Tylenol. I needed... The disposable cell phone buzzed, alerting me to a text as I approached the Jefferson Davis Parish seat along a westward curve in the Evangeline Highway. At a stop sign, I picked the phone up and read it. "Go to New Orleans," it said, "alone. You have until 4:30 a.m. to reach the Big Easy. Announce your arrival in the casual encounters section of Craigslist, women looking for men. Do as I say, and you will see your family alive. Try to be clever and involve any kind of law enforcement, and you will see your family dead. This is your last hope, Cross. Don't blow it now when you're so close to your goal. By the way, the phone that sent this text will be destroyed upon your response." In all honesty, I wanted to smash my own phone to smithereens. I was exhausted. I was sick of being played. I didn't know if I had it in me to go on much longer, if at all. When I read the message a second and a third time, however, I kept pausing on that phrase, "your last hope." It was like Sunday was dangling a strip of meat over a caged and starving dog that had had enough of cruelty. I didn't want to lunge at the offer just out of reach, but knew I would. Despite the anger, the fatigue, and the resentment, I could not help but grasp at the final straw. I simply could not leave hope to die. "I'm coming, Sunday," I texted back. "Alone." Chapter 81. I bought two ham and cheese sandwiches and three cups of French roast coffee at an all-night gas station near the on-ramp to the I-10. The sandwiches tasted like they'd been made days ago, and the coffee was stale and bitter. But I forced it all down as I sped east in a driving rain. Were Bree, the kids, and my grandmother in New Orleans? Was that where Sunday had taken them? Why there? Some of Mulch's actions seemed as random as they were brutal. Or maybe that was simply a lack of information on my part. What drove a guy to do these things? He'd escaped his childhood with millions of dollars, and then had indulged his desire for an education with a doctorate from Harvard. Marcus Sunday could have lived a comfortable life of the mind. Instead, he'd viciously slain his mother for escaping her past, and Alice Monahan and her entire family for reasons I still couldn't fathom. Then he had the gall to write an entire book about the mass killings, extolling the murderer as a perfect killer who had left no trace and would never be identified. The crazy thing was that Sunday might have been right if he hadn't decided, for whatever disturbed reason, to make me and my family the target of his ongoing homicidal vengeance. I still didn't get that, and it gnawed at me as I passed Lafayette and drove on toward Baton Rouge. Other than the phone interviews and my giving Sunday a mediocre review in the Post, okay, a thumbs-down review in the Post, I'd had no contact with the man that I knew of. So why me? Perhaps because of my reputation, he saw me as some kind of threat. Maybe he feared I was going to eventually uncover his role in the Omaha and Fort Worth killings. Or maybe this entire cruelty had grown out of something I hadn't seen or heard yet. Had Bree done something to him at some point in her past? I couldn't see it. No, this was about me. It had always been about me. But what if I was just an arbitrary object? What if some chemical in his dysfunctional brain had dripped at just the right time, and he'd obsessed on me like Mark David Chapman keyed in on John Lennon, deciding to punish me for no particular reason at all? I think the idea that it might have been utterly random upset me the most. In spite of everything that had happened to me in the past 12 days, I still believed in my Lord and God and in the idea that He had a plan for us all. But as I drove through the night toward a showdown or an ambush, Sunday was testing the limits of my faith. It occurred to me that he hadn't said anything about the video of the double homicide I was supposed to send him later today. Seemed that wasn't important to him anymore. He just wanted me in New Orleans. Crossing the Atchafalaya River, I was hit with waves of doubt and surges of raw emotion that brought tears to my eyes. What if, after enduring it all, I simply found them dead? What if it was as random as that? I swiped at the tears with my sleeve and prayed, "Please don't let that happen. Take me if you want, but dear God, let them live." The rain slowed, and I sped up toward the National Wildlife Refuge and the elevated highway that separates Lafayette from Baton Rouge. For several miles, there was a strange, dead calm when the wind and rain stopped altogether. I sped up even more, going 68 now. Then, out of nowhere, gusts of wind rose up, turned gale force, buffeted the car, and sent leaves ripped from trees down in the refuge windmilling across the already slick surface of the highway. A small sedan in front and to the right of me fishtailed on the wet leaves, corrected, and almost straightened out. Then it swung violently sideways into my lane, and I had to swerve, throwing my car hard to the right. I'd taken all sorts of defensive driving classes in the course of my career, but nothing I knew could save me from smashing my right front fender into the guardrail. Going better than 60 when it hit, the car upended, spiraled up, and cleared the guardrail before plunging into darkness. Chapter 82. Meteorological data would later conclude that four different tornadoes hit southern Louisiana that night. The third, an EF2 level twister, formed near Ville Platte around 1:35 a.m. and wrecked destruction all